said Grace, throwing Lee a look. Yeah, I do. I mean, I steer clear, said Lee. Grace went on. It used to be nice round here. Nothing posh, but nice. That rough old Wetherspoons used to be a lovely Odeon. The worst are the Glue Pot and the Stag. I tell you, if the world was flooded with piss and those two boozers were above the waterline, you wouldn't catch me in there. And they're swarming with bloody immigrants, no offence, love, she added to Peterson. Erica noticed Moss suppress a smile. Grace continued, still oblivious to Lee's distress. I tell you, I go out down the high street and I feel like a foreigner in my own country. Polish, Romanian, Ukrainian, Russian, Indian, African. And Lee tells me they're all down the job centre, hands out taking what they can. You should raid those pubs on the high street. Loads of them work behind the bar and nip out in their tea breaks to sign on. But no, there's a blind eye turned to that. Ismail Lee has got to come out in all weather and work a 40-hour week for 60 quid's worth of benefits. It's disgusting. How long have you been working in the museum grounds? Asked Erica. Lee shrugged. I did 4 weeks before Christmas. And I suppose it'll be Lee's fault he can't work, cause some stupid prostitute went and got herself. That's enough, said Erica. Grace seemed chastised. I suppose she's still someone's daughter. Do you know who she is? We can't say at this stage. This aroused Grace's interest. It wasn't that girl, the posh one who's gone missing. What was her name, Lee? Angela? Did she look like that girl in the paper? Lee was now staring blankly ahead, seemingly reliving the moment he'd come face to face with Andrea through a sheet of ice. As I said, we still need to identify the body, said Erica. We'll contact the job centre for you, Lee, and let them know what's going on. Do stay in the local area. We might have to talk to you again. You think he's going to leave the country, do you? Snapped Grace. Chance will be a fine thing, although round here we'd probably be the only ones leaving. Erica, Moss and Peterson left as the paramedics began to ready the ambulance for leaving. She was a bit of a handful, said Moss. But she gave us more information than Lee, said Erica. Let's check out those pubs, the Glue Pot, the Stag. Could Andrea have been in one of those the night she went missing? Chapter 6 There was a fresh onslaught of snow when they emerged from the museum, so they ditched the squad car and took the overland train to London Bridge and then the tube over to Chiswick. The tube was cramped and hot, and they had to stand most of the journey in a tightly packed huddle, with Erica sandwiched between her new colleagues. Peterson's lean frame was contrasted by the dumpy bulk of Moss pressed against her other side. Erica wished she could have 5 minutes to herself, some space and fresh air to gather her thoughts. In 25 years of police investigations, she'd informed what seemed like hundreds of people that they had lost loved ones. But since experiencing the other side of loss, she felt different. The pain was still so raw. And now she was going to have to tell Andrea's parents and watch the now familiar grief as it consumed them. Snow had stopped falling when they emerged from Turnham Green Tube Station. Chiswick High Road was polished in comparison to South London. The streets were clean with freshly painted postboxes, and independent butchers and organic stores mingled amongst the Victorian terraced houses with their spotless sash windows. The banks and supermarkets had a zing and a gleam. Even the snow seemed whiter. The Douglas Brown's house was in a large, sweeping cul-de-sac, set back from the busy high street. Their supersized Georgian house had been sandblasted. The removal of years of soot and smog exposing brickwork the colour of butter. It dominated the other houses, despite being partly hidden by the tall trees growing in a small park at the centre of the cul-de-sac. Footprints tracked across the snow, where a group of photographers milled about, cameras slung over their warm winter coats, steam rising from their takeaway cups of coffee. Their interest was piqued as Erica, Moss and Peterson approached the house, entering through the front gate. Camera shutters began to click, flashes bouncing off the high-gloss black paint of the Douglas Brown's stout front door. Erica took a deep breath and pressed the bell. An elegant chime sounded deep inside. "Are you police?" shouted a voice from behind them. "The dead body, is it, Andy?" shouted another. Erica closed her eyes for a moment, feeling the photographers like a heavy presence behind. What bloody right did they have to call her Andy? Not even her parents called her that. The front door opened, but only partially, and a tiny dark-haired old lady looked up at them through a gap. She lifted a hand to shield her eyes as the camera flashes intensified. "Good morning. We need to speak with Simon and Diana Douglas Brown, please," said Erica. And the three officers flashed their IDs. They expected the lady to usher them in, but she peered up at them from under hooded eyelids, the camera flashes reflecting in her black eyes.
"You're inquiring about the Lord and Lady Douglas Brown?"
"Yes, it's regarding the disappearance of their daughter, Andrea," said Erica quietly. "I'm the Douglas Brown's housekeeper. Please give me your identification," said the little woman, "and wait here whilst I confirm who you are." She collected up their IDs and closed the door. Fresh camera flashes bounced off the paintwork.
"Can you confirm she was raped?" shouted a voice. "Can you confirm it's murder? And if so, do you believe it was politically motivated?" shouted another.
Erica gave Moss and Peterson a sideways glance, and they kept facing the door. Seconds ticked by. They could almost feel the heat of the camera flashes on their backs.
"What does she think we're trying to do, sell them fucking double-glazing?" hissed Moss quietly.
"Lord Douglas was involved in a hidden camera sting last year," said Peterson from the corner of his mouth. "The News of the World caught him on film trying to bribe a defence contractor from Tehran."
"The fake sheikh," murmured Erica. She was about to say more when the door opened a little wider this time. The camera shutters from behind intensified.
"Yes, they all seem in order," said the little woman, returning their IDs and beckoning them through the gap. They followed her inside, and she closed the door against the cold and photographers.
The narrow hallway opened out into a gallery, where an elegant carpeted wooden staircase snaked up around three floors. High above was a round stained glass skylight, which played a pattern of soft colours over the creamy walls. A glossy grandfather clock sat at the base of the stairs, its pendulum swinging silently. The housekeeper led them down a corridor, past a doorway through which they glimpsed a large steel and granite kitchen, and past an enormous gilt mirror, underneath which sat an equally impressive vase of fresh flowers. They arrived at an oak door, and were led through to a study overlooking the snow-covered back garden.
"Please wait," the housekeeper said, eyeing them as she backed out of the room and closed the door.
Underneath a sash window was a sturdy desk of dark wood. Its leather surface was empty, apart from a sleek silver laptop. A bookcase filled the wall to the left, and a large leather button-back sofa and two armchairs stood on the right. Above them was a wall covered in framed photographs of Simon Douglas Brown, who Erica recognised from the press reports of Andrea's disappearance. He was a short, virile-looking man with intense brown eyes. The photos charted his achievements, beginning with a full head of hair when his technology company was listed on the London Stock Exchange in 1987, progressing, as the hair thinned out, through a series of photos with the Queen, Margaret Thatcher, John Major, and then Tony Blair. Erica noted that Her Majesty was a good few inches taller than Lord Douglas Brown. There were four photos taken with Tony Blair, showing just how involved Douglas Brown had become in the workings of the Labour government. Two photos, larger than the rest, had pride of place in the centre of the collage. The first was an official portrait, where Douglas Brown stood amongst red carpet and wood panelling wearing a cloak of ermine. A caption underneath showed it was taken on the day of his investiture, when he had been knighted, becoming Baron Simon Douglas Brown of Huntsdanton. In the second photo, he struck the same pose, but this time with the addition of his wife Diana, small and fine-boned beside him in an elegant white dress. She had long dark hair and looked like an older, more pinched version of Andrea.
"Where is Huntsdanton?" asked Erica.
"Norfolk Coast. It's got a very nice sea life centre," said Moss, leaning into the photo with a deadpan face.
"So his wife became Lady Diana," said Peterson.
"Yeah," said Moss, "and it doesn't seem the title has brought her much luck either."
"Is this just a love for you two?" snapped Erica, "because I don't remember anything funny about Andrea's body when it was pulled out of the ice."
Moss and Peterson apologised hastily. The three of them looked at the last of the photos in an awkward silence.
Lord and Lady Douglas Brown with President Barack Obama and his wife Michelle. The Obamas towered over the Douglas Browns, who had pulled their faces into smiles verging on mania. No doubt, out of shot, there was a long line of lords, ladies, diplomats, captains of industry and their skinny wives waiting to step into the frame for an identical picture. A meeting of mere seconds, preserved for an eternity on the ego wall. They were roused from the photo wall by a cough and turned to see Simon and Diana Douglas Brown in the study doorway. Erica felt immediate guilt for passing judgment, for the two people standing expectantly in front of them were nothing more than terrified parents.
"Please, just tell us what's going on. Is it Andrea?" asked Diana.
Erica detected an accent under Diana's well-spoken English, one much like Erica's own.
"Please sit down," said Erica.
Diana saw their expressions and put her hands over her face.
"No, no, 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 it's not her, not my baby, please, not my baby."
Simon put an arm around his wife. "I'm very sorry to inform you that your daughter's body was found this morning in the grounds of the Horniman Museum in South London," said Erica.
"And you're sure it's her?"
asked Simon. "Yes, we found Andrea's driving license on her, person, and a mobile phone registered to Andrea was at the scene," said Erica. "We're doing everything we can to establish her cause of death. But I need to tell you that we believe it was suspicious. We believe that Andrea was murdered."
"Murdered?"
Diana pulled away and sank down into a sofa by the bookcase, her hand still over her face. Simon's olive skin had drained of colour, giving him a green pallor.
"Andrea murdered?" Diana repeated. "Who would murder her?"
Erica paused and then said, "I'm afraid we'll need you to come and formally identify Andrea's body." There was another silence. A clock chimed in the depths of the building. Diana took her hands from her face and looked up at Erica, studying her.
"Odgielste," she said. "Narodilo som sa v Nitre,"
replied Erica.
"No, Slovak, not now. Let's speak English," said Simon.
"What's a woman from Nitra doing telling me that my daughter is dead?"
said Diana, fixing Erica with a stare. It was challenging. "Like you, I've lived in England for longer than I lived in Slovakia," explained Erica.
"You're nothing like me. Where's the other officer? The one who was here before? Sparks? I don't want the fate of our daughter resting on the skills of some Slovakian."
"Mrs. Douglas Brown," said Erica, feeling anger rise in her. "It's Lady Douglas Brown."
Erica snapped.
"I've been a police officer for 25 years, a detective chief inspector for..."
"I can assure you we're doing everything we can to find the person who did this," said Peterson, stepping in and shooting Erica a look.
Erica composed herself and pulled out her notebook, flicking through to a blank page.
"If I may, Lady Diana, I would like to ask you a few questions."
"No, no, you may not,"
said Simon, his dark eyes hardening.
"Can't you see my wife is... I need to make some phone calls. Where did you say you were from?"
"Nitra is in western Slovakia, but as I said, I've been in England for over 20 years.
"I'm not asking for your bloody life story. I'm asking whether you are Metropolitan Police."
"Yes, we're from Lewisham Row Station," said Erica.
"Right, well, I want to make some calls, find out the lay of the land. I've been dealing directly with Assistant Commissioner Oakley."
"Sir, I'm leading the investigation,
and I've worked with Commander Clive Robinson on several police steering committees and..."
"And whilst I respect that, you have to understand that I am now leading this investigation and I need to ask you both some questions."
Too late. Erica realised her voice had risen to a shout. There was a silence.
"Boss, can I have a word?" asked Peterson.
He glanced at Moss and she gave a small, almost imperceptible nod. Erica felt her face flush.
"Boss, a word now," said Peterson.
Erica rose and followed him out into the corridor. He closed the door. She leant against the wall and tried to slow her breathing.
"I know," she said. "Look, I'm not getting up in your face, boss. You've come into a shitstorm and I accept that. But you can't get aggressive with a victim's parents, because right now that's all they are, parents. Let him posture, but we know how it's going to work from here on."
"I know, shit," said Erica. "Oh, shit."
"Why did the mother want to know where you were from in Slovenia?"
"Slovakia,"
corrected Erica. It's a well-known Slovak attitude. The people who come from Bratislava think they're better than everyone else. I presume that's where she's from. And she thinks that makes her better than you, finished Peterson.
Erica breathed in and nodded, trying to calm her anger. Two men in overalls were approaching from the other end of the corridor, pulling a huge Christmas tree. Erica and Peterson parted to let them through. The tree had dried out and was brown in places, and as its branches brushed the walls, pine needles shed and sprayed across the thick blue and green carpet. Peterson looked as if he was going to say more, then thought better of it and took a different tack.
It's way past lunchtime. You look like you could use a sugar rush, he said, studying Erica's white face. I know you're the boss, but how about you go off and meet us round the corner at a pub or a caff? I'll go in and apologize. Boss, let the dust settle, yeah? We'll get as much info as we can and come and find you. Yeah, okay, but if you can... I'll arrange for them to do the ID, yes. And we'll need Andrea's laptop and, well, just get as much as you can for now.
Peterson nodded and went back inside the study. Erica paused for a moment. She'd totally blown it and was coming away with nothing. She was about to have a look round the house when the housekeeper with the hooded eyes reappeared.
I'll show you out, shall I? She insisted.
They followed the trail of dead pine needles to the front door. When Erica was deposited outside on the step, in front of the flashing cameras, she had to bite down hard on her bottom lip to keep herself from crying. Chapter 7 The light was starting to fade when Moss and Peterson caught up with Erica in a coffee shop on Chiswick High Road. She spent a frustrating hour sitting by the window, watching the light fade on a day that had seemed so long, but in which she felt she'd achieved nothing. It wasn't like her to go roaring in on an interview and balls it up, especially not with the parents of the victim. The cafe had been quiet when Erica had arrived, but had now filled up and was bustling with fashionable singletons and a pack of yummy mummies who'd marked out a corner of the coffee shop with a barrier of expensive buggies. Peterson and Moss bought coffee and sandwiches, then came over the table to join Erica.
Look, thanks for stepping in there. I don't know what happened. My judgment was off, explained Erica, feeling embarrassed.
No probs, said Peterson, tearing open a sandwich box and taking a huge bite.
Diana Douglas Brown was out of order, but then again it wasn't the best day of her life, was it?
Agreed Moss, taking a bite of her sandwich.
Yeah, but I shouldn't have. Anyway, what else can you tell me? Asked Erica.
She waited for a moment, whilst they both finished chewing.
Simon and Diana don't know why Andrea was in South London, said Moss. She'd arranged to go to the cinema with David and Linda, the brother and sister. They waited for her at the Odeon in Hammersmith, but she never showed up.
Were the brother and sister at home?
Yeah, David, he was asleep upstairs. Lady Diana didn't want to wake him.
Wake him? Isn't he in his 20s? Asked Erica.
David had been awake since the early hours, apparently, said Moss. They'd been taking it in turns to watch the phones throughout the night in case Andrea called. It seems she's gone missing before.
When? Do we have a record?
No, they never reported it. A couple of years back, she went AWOL over a long weekend. Turned out she went off to France with some guy she'd met in a bar. She came back when she maxed out her credit card.
Did you get the name of the person she ran off with?
Yeah, a Carl Michaels. He was a student at the time. It was nothing dodgy. A dirty weekend with the added bonus that Andrea had a platinum Visa card, said Moss.
Did you see the sister, Linda? Asked Erica. She came in with a tray of tea. We thought she was the maid. Looks very different to Andrea. Frumpy, a bit fat. She works at the mother's florists, said Peterson.
And how did she react to the news? Asked Erica.
She dropped the tray, although... Moss hesitated.
What? Asked Erica, wishing again that she didn't have to hear this all second-hand.
Moss looked at Peterson.
It seemed a bit cod, the way she reacted, he said.
Cod? Asked Erica.
You know, like bad acting. I dunno, people react in all sorts of weird ways. The whole family seems a bit screwed up, if you ask me, said Peterson.
Then again, whose family isn't screwed up? Added Moss. Plus, you throw money into the mix and everything gets heightened.
A phone began to ring,
and it took a few moments before Erica realized it was hers. She pulled it out and answered. It was Isaac, telling her that the bad weather had slowed everything right down. The results of the autopsy would be ready in the morning. "I really wanted them to ID the body tonight," said Erica when she came off the phone.
"It could work in your favour. It'll give Sir Simon a chance to cool off," said Peterson.
"Did he say anything else?"
asked Erica.
"Yeah, he wants Sparks back on the case,"
said Moss. They carried on chewing in silence. It was now dark. Car headlights crawled past, illuminating the incessant snow falling outside. Chapter 8 Erica, Moss and Peterson arrived back at Lewisham Road just after 7 p.m. They went straight to the incident room, which was full, the police officers waiting expectantly to share the day's findings. Erica sloughed off her long leather jacket and went to the huge bank of whiteboards lining the back of the room.
"Okay, everyone, I know it's been a long day, but what have we got?"
"How did you get on when you met the family? How did Sir Simon take to you, DCI Foster?"
smirked Sparks, leaning back in his chair. On cue, Superintendent Marsh pulled open the door to the incident room.
"Foster, a word."
"Sir, I'm just briefing everyone on the day's events."
"Okay, but my office the second you're done," he barked and slammed the door.
"So it went well, I take it?"
needled Sparks, his nasty smile tinted with the white blue of his computer screen. Erica ignored him and turned back to the whiteboard. Beside Andrea's photo were pictures of Linda and David. She noticed with interest that Andrea and her brother were very attractive, but Linda was overweight and matronly, with a pointed nose and a whiter complexion than her siblings.
"Are the kids all from the same parents?"
asked Erica, tapping the board with her marker pen. This took the incident room off guard. Sergeant Crane looked round in surprise.
"We assumed yes."
"Why did you assume this?"
asked Erica.
"Well, they seem quite..."
"Posh?" asked Erica.
"Never forget, we look at family first and foremost as suspects. Don't let yourselves be blinded by the fact that they live in an expensive area of London and have influence and power. Crane, you can look into the children, but of course be discreet. Now we know that Andrea was due to meet David and Linda at the cinema last Thursday, the 8th, but she never showed up. Where did she go? Was she meeting a friend, a secret lover? Who was looking specifically into Andrea's life?"
A small Indian woman in her 20s stood up.
"PC Singh," she said.
She came to the front and Erica handed her the marker pen.
"Andrea's been in a relationship with 27-year-old Giles Osborne for the past 8 months. They'd recently got engaged. He owns Yakka Events, an upmarket events and party planning company based in Kensington."
"Yakka Events? What does Yakka mean?" asked Erica.
"It's the Aboriginal word for work. It says on the company website that he spent his gap year in Australia."
"Learning how to serve canapés and champagne from the Aborigines?" asked Erica. A flicker of a smile passed through the incident room.
"He's privately educated, comes from a wealthy family. He has an alibi for the night Andrea went missing."
"I've already interviewed him. We found this out last week," interrupted Sparks.
"What about the records for Andrea's phone and social media? I take it those have been requested?"
"Yes," said Singh.
"Where are they?"
"I'm on it. I requested them this morning, so we're hoping to get them in the next 24 hours, said Crane.
"Why weren't they requested before when she became a missing person?" asked Erica. There was silence.
"Worried you were prying into the lives of the influential rich people?"
"I made the call not to go ahead and request those," said Sparks. "The family was still under the impression that Andrea had taken off somewhere. They were monitoring her social media accounts and sharing information with us."
Erica rolled her eyes. "I want those records the second we have them, and anything that gets pulled off the phone hard drive," she said to Crane.
"Now, Sparks, you seem full of the joys of late winter. What did you manage to find with the CCTV?
DCI Sparks leaned back in his chair with a creak.
"Not good news, I'm afraid. Until a couple of days ago, 3 of the CCTV cameras on the London Road were down, so we've got nothing around the train station forecourt or leading up the high street to the Horniman Museum. Of course, the back roads aren't covered either, so we're blind to the events on the night of the 8th.
Shit, said Erica.
We have got her coming off the train at Forest Hill Station at...
Sparks flicked through his notes. 9:06 p.m. She comes off the train, goes along the platform, and leaves past the ticket office. It was unmanned and only a couple of other people got off at the same time.
Can we find out who they are? Maybe they walked up with her.
I'm already on it, Sparks finished.
What about the door-to-door?
Sergeant Crane leaned forward in his chair, saying,
Not a great deal, boss. Most people were either still away after their Christmas break or asleep.
What about any pubs?
The Wetherspoons and the Pig and Whistle have CCTV. She didn't go into either of those. There's another 4 pubs on the high street.
Grace Kinney mentioned 2, the Glue Pot and the Stag.
We've been to them all. Pretty rough shitholes they are too, boss. And no one who works there remembers seeing her.
Look at staff rotors, find out who the locals are. Check again. She was dressed for a night out. There's a high chance she did go into one of those pubs.
What if she was going to a house party?
Asked Singh.
Okay, then what about off-licenses? Did she go into any to buy fags or booze?
Again, the off-licenses do have CCTV, tends to be patchy, but none of them saw her, said Crane.
What about outside the house where a bag was found?
Yes, number 49, and unfortunately nothing again. Homeowner is a gaga old lady with a live-in carer. Neither of them saw or heard anything.
There was an uncomfortable silence.
Perhaps you should let your team get some rest. It's been a long day, said Sparks.
Yeah, okay, let's meet back here at 9 tomorrow. We should have the autopsy results by then and the phone and social media records.
Erica said goodnight to her officers. And when she was last in the incident room, she looked over at the whiteboards in silence, lingering over Andrea's picture.
Look at you. Just 23. You had your whole life ahead of you.
Andrea stared back at her, defiantly, almost mocking her.
Erica jumped as her phone rang.
Do you want to keep me waiting any longer? Barked Marsh.
Shit, sorry, sir. I'm on my way up.
Chapter 9.
So what you're telling me is you've got nothing, said Marsh.
He was red in the face as he paced up and down his office. Erica had just underlined the progress made during the first day of investigations.
This is day one, sir, and as I said, there's a positive ID on the victim. I've kept it out of the press. I think there's one or two pubs where Andrea might possibly be placed the night she vanished.
Might possibly be placed? What does that mean?
It means we're hampered by a CCTV black spot all up the London Road and around the train station. We need time and resources to keep on at people asking questions. Everyone has worked bloody hard, especially when the weather has slowed proceedings.
And what the hell did you think you were doing, getting into a row with the Douglas Browns?
Erica took a deep breath to steady herself. I admit, sir, that I should have handled the victim's parents better.
Too bloody right you should have. I thought Lady Diana would have found some common ground with you being Slovak.
Yes, well, that was the problem. She thought I was common, not good enough to be leading the murder investigation.
Yeah, well, you didn't choose to be a police officer, so people could be nice to you, DCI Foster.
There is a course I can send you on, dealing with the public.
That's the problem. We're not treating them as members of the public. In fact, is Sir Simon leading the investigation? He seems to think he's in charge. Anyway, who told you about what happened? He called you, didn't he? Knows your direct line number.
You're on thin ice, DCI Foster, said Marsh. He called DCI Sparks, actually, who relayed the message to me.
How good of him.
Marsh shot her a look.
I stuck my neck out on this to get you on the case. I don't want your pity, sir, and if you're not careful, you'll be gone before you've even started. You need to learn how to keep your mouth shut. I got you on this case because you're a bloody good copper, one of the best I know. Although right now I'm questioning my judgment.
I'm sorry, sir, it's just been a long day. Tough conditions and no sleep. But you know me, I don't make excuses, and I will find who did this.
Okay, said Marsh, calming down. But you need to apologise sincerely to the Douglas Browns.
Yes, sir. And get a decent night's sleep. You look like shit.
Thanks, sir.
Where are you staying?
A hotel.
Good. Now bugger off and come to work tomorrow with your head screwed on, said Marsh, waving her away.
Erica was furious when she left Marsh's office, furious that she'd been given a dressing down,
and furious with herself that she'd messed up. She went back down to the incident room and grabbed her coat. Andrea's picture stared boldly back at her from the centre of the whiteboard. The handwritten notes on the case blurred in the bright lights, and Erica rubbed her tired eyes. It felt like she was looking at everything through murky glass. She couldn't get a handle on the details. Tiredness and anger washed over her again. She pulled on her coat and left, flicking off the light. When she came out of the incident room, she met Desk Sergeant Wolf in the corridor. "I was just coming to tell you we've sorted you a car. It's a blue Ford Mondeo," he said, holding out a key fob, his jowly face more sullen than it had been that morning. "Thanks," said Erica, taking the key. They made for the main entrance, Wolf struggling a little to match her stride. "I didn't put your suitcase in, though. I did my back in a few years ago. Had to have a disc removed.
It's behind my desk."
They emerged into the reception area, where a thin, bedraggled woman was leaning over Wolf's desk using his phone. She wore filthy, ripped jeans and an old parka jacket that was stained and covered in cigarette burns. Her long grey hair was tied back with an elastic band, and underneath her eyes were deep, dark circles. Two unkempt little girls beside her were shrieking encouragement at a little boy with a buzz cut who sat on Erica's suitcase. He wore a pair of stained white tracksuit bottoms and was gyrating his hips with one hand on the suitcase handle and the other in the air, like he was riding a bucking bronco. Wolf hurried behind his desk and put his finger on the phone, cutting off the call. "I was fucking talking," snarled the woman indignantly, displaying a mouth of crooked round teeth. "Ivy, this is a police phone," said Wolf. "Well, he ain't rung for the past 10 minutes. Think yourself lucky the criminals are having a rest." "Who do you want to call? I could do it for you," said Wolf. "I know how to use a fucking phone." "Who is this woman?" asked Erica. Ivy held the receiver away from Wolf and gave Erica the once-over, saying, "Me and Droopy go way back, don't we, Droopy? I call him Droopy. Ugly fucking bastard, ain't he?" "You get off my suitcase," said Erica to the boy, who couldn't have been more than 7 or 8. He ignored her and carried on whooping and riding the suitcase. Wolf grappled with Ivy for the receiver and finally managed to prize it from her grip. "I should be allowed to use this bloody phone. It's only a local call, and besides, I pay your wages." "How do you pay my wages?" asked Wolf. "I've got money, I pay me taxes, and that's what pays your wages." Erica went to lift the little boy off her suitcase, but he leaned over and sank his teeth into the back of her hand. The intensity of the pain surprised her. "Let go now," said Erica, trying to keep calm. He looked up at her with a nasty grin and bit down even harder. Intense pain shot through her hand and she snapped, slapping him hard across the face. He screamed, releasing Erica's hand, and fell off the suitcase, hitting the ground with a thud. "Who do you think you fucking are?" growled Ivy, lunging across at her. Erica tried to dodge out of the way but found herself with her back flat against the wall. Wolf caught Ivy just in time as a long blade glinted inches from Erica's face. "Ivy, now come on, just cool it," started Wolf, restraining her under the armpits, but still struggling to hold her back. "Don't you tell me to cool it, you fat ugly cunt," said Ivy, dangerously. "You touch my kids and I'll cut your face, no problem, you bitch. I've got nothing to lose." Erica tried to control her breathing as she saw the flick knife inch closer to her face. "Let go of the knife, let go," said Wolf, finally gaining a grip on Ivy's wrist and twisting the flick knife out of her hand. It clattered to the floor and he put his foot over it. "You didn't have to be so rough, Droopy," said Ivy, rubbing her wrist. Wolf kept his eye on her as he leant down and retrieved the knife from the floor. He found the small release button and the blade vanished back into its handle. The little boy and two girls had ceased to be threatening and rowdy. They were just kids, and they seemed more afraid of what Ivy was going to do next. Erica couldn't imagine the life they must lead. She looked at the little boy, who was holding the back of his head. "I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. What's your name?"
He shrank back from her.
What could she say to him? That she'd had a bad day? Erica took in their filthy clothes, their malnourished bodies.
"I want to make a complaint," said Ivy with relish.
"Oh, do you?"
said Wolf, moving Ivy towards the main door.
Yeah, police brutality. Get your hands off me. Police brutality towards a minor.
You'll need to fill in a form, said Wolf, before you spend the night in the cells for pulling a knife on a police officer.
Ivy narrowed her eyes.
Nah, I haven't got fucking time. Come on, kids, now!
She gave Erica a last look, and they followed after her through the main door. There was a flash of coats as they passed the window.
Shit!
Said Erica, slumping against the main desk and rubbing at the back of her hand. I shouldn't have hit that kid. There was a white and purple ridge of teeth marks deep in her skin, and a blur of blood mingling with the little boy's saliva. Wolf went to a box marked Knife Amnesty, where he deposited Ivy's flick knife. He then moved back round the desk and pulled down a first aid kit. He placed it on the table beside Erica and opened the lid. You know her? Asked Erica. Oh, yes, Ivy Norris, or Jean McArdle, Beth Crosby. Sometimes she goes by Paulette O'Brien. Bit of a local celebrity. He poured some alcohol solution on a sterile dressing and pressed it against the back of Erica's hand over the bite marks. The nasty stinging sensation was contrasted by a comforting smell of mint. Wolf went on, She's a long-term drug addict, prostitute, got a record as long as the Great Wall of China. She used to do a mother and daughter speciality, if you know what I mean, until the daughter died of a drug overdose. And the kids' fathers? They're actually her grandkids, and who knows? Stick your finger in the phone book. Wolf removed the dressing and started to clean the bloody bite mark with a fresh one. Are they homeless? Wolf nodded. Could we get them into emergency social services, bed and breakfast? Asked Erica. She could still see Ivy standing in the car park, smoking under the harsh lights and mouthing off to no one in particular. The kids were huddled around her, flinching as she gestured with her arms. Wolf laughed darkly. She's banned from most of the B&Bs and hostels for soliciting. He lifted off the bandage and applied a large square plaster to the back of Erica's hand. Thanks, said Erica, flexing her fingers. Wolf started to pack up the first aid kit. Now you know what I'm going to tell you. You need to see a doctor about the bite. Get a tetanus jab. And, you know, street kids, not healthy. Yeah, said Erica. And I have to log this down, everything what happened. She pulled a knife on you. He bit you. Yeah, and I hit him. I hit a bloody kid. It's fine, do your job and thank you. He nodded, took his seat again and pulled out some paperwork. Erica turned back to look outside, but Ivy and the kids were gone. Chapter 10. It was bitingly cold outside. The main entrance of Lewisham Row Police Station was lit up, but the car park was a pool of darkness. Long rows of cars twinkled with frost under the street lamps, and beyond, the traffic crawled steadily by. Erica's hand was still throbbing. She pointed the key fob to her left and clicked, then did the same to her right. A car down the far end of the car park gave two pulses of orange light. She cursed and set off, dragging her case through the deep snow. She stowed the case in the boot and got inside. The car was freezing, but smelt new. She turned on the engine and activated the central locking. When the heaters had warmed the inside up a little, she pulled out of the parking space and drove slowly towards the exit. Ivy was standing on the pavement outside. The children were huddled together under her arms, shivering uncontrollably. Erica stopped level with them and opened her window. "Where are you going, Ivy?" she asked. Ivy turned, the wind catching a wisp of her long grey hair and pressing it against her face.
"What's it got to do with you?"
said Ivy.
"I can give you a lift."
"Why would we get in a car with a kiddie-bashing pig?"
"I'm sorry, I was really out of order. I've had a bad day."
"You've had a bad day. Try being me, love,"
snorted Ivy.
"I can take you wherever you need to go, and the kids can warm up," said Erica,
noting the little girl's bare legs underneath their thin dresses. Ivy narrowed her eyes.
"What do I have to do in return?"
"All you have to do is sit in the car," said Erica. She dug out a £20 note. Ivy went to take it, but Erica held it away.
"You get it when I drop you off, provided there's no more knives or biting."
Ivy shot the little boy a look, and he nodded obediently.
"Fine," she said.
She opened the back door and the kids clambered in, crawling across the back seat. When Ivy got in beside Erica, she gave off a nasty tramp-like whiff. Erica swallowed the fear of Ivy's proximity. "Seat belts," she said, thinking that it would be safer for her if they were all strapped down. "Yeah, we wouldn't want to break the law," laughed Ivy, pulling the seat belt round and fastening it with a click. "Where do you want to go?" "Catford," said Ivy. Erica pulled out her phone and clicked on her Google Maps app.
"Bloody hell," said Ivy. "I'll direct you. Go left."
The car was a very smooth drive, and as the street lights played over the windscreen, the unusual combination of Ivy, her grandchildren and Erica settled into an almost comfortable silence.
"So, you got any kids?" asked Ivy.
"No," said Erica. She put on the windscreen wipers as a dusting of snow hit the windscreen.
"You a lezzer?"
"No."
"Don't bother me, I don't mind lezzers. You can have a good drink with a lezzer, and they're good at DIY. I tried it once, mind. Didn't like the taste."
"Of what, DIY?" joked Erica.
"Very funny. Saying that, I'm thinking of going lezzer again. I'll have to split the money, but I'm getting sick of the taste of cock."
Erica looked across at her.
"Come on, love, you didn't think I worked in Marks and Spencer's, did ya?"
"Where do you live?" asked Erica.
"Why should I tell you where I fucking live?"
Ivy lurched towards her, but her seatbelt locked, holding her in place.
"Easy. You just told me that you're sick of the taste of cock. I thought asking for your address wouldn't be too impolite." "Don't you try and be clever with me. I know you. Like your job, do you? Got any friends?"
There was a silence.
"No, I thought not. Never off duty, are you? You lot would shop your own mother. Left here."
Erica put on the indicator and turned. "I don't live anywhere right now," she said, figuring she could offer up some info of her own. "My husband died recently, and I've been away and..."
"And you lost your marbles, yeah?"
"No, but I came close," said Erica.
"My husband was stabbed years ago, bled to death in me arms." "Go right here. You're all right, though, ain't you? Good job. I could have been a police officer or something better," sneered Ivy.
"You know this area well, then?" asked Erica.
"Yeah, been here me whole life."
"What bars do you recommend?"
"What bars do I recommend?" she said, mimicking Erica. "Okay, what bars do you know?" "I know 'em all. As I just said, I've been round here for years. Seen places come and go. The rough ones last the longest."
They passed the Catford Broadway Theatre, the front lit up, still advertising the Christmas pantomime.
"Drop us here," said Ivy.
Catford High Street was deserted. Erica pulled up by a pedestrian crossing next to a Ladbrokes betting shop and a branch of Halifax.
"There aren't any houses," said Erica. "I told you I ain't got a ass."
"Where are you staying, then?"
"I've got business to attend to. Come on, wake 'em up," snapped Ivy to the boy.
Erica looked through her rear-view mirror. The two girls were asleep, their heads leant together. The boy stared back at her with a white face.
"I'm sorry I hit you,"
said Erica. His face remained impassive.
"Leave it out, just give me the money,"
said Ivy, unclipping her seatbelt and opening the car door. Erica fumbled in her coat and brought out the 20. Ivy took the note, stuffing it in the folds of her parka.
"Before you go, Ivy, what do you know about pubs in Forest Hill? The Stag?" "There's a stripper there who'll do anything once her pint glass is full of pound coins," said Ivy.
"And what about the glue pot?" asked Erica. Ivy's whole body language changed. Her eyes went wide.
"I don't know nothing about that place," she said hoarsely.
"You just said you knew all the bars around here. Come on, tell me about the glue pot."
"I don't ever go in there," Ivy whispered, "and I don't know nothing. You hear me?"
"Why not?" Ivy paused and looked at Erica.
"I'd get that hand looked at. Little Mike, he's HIV positive."
She got out, slamming the door, and vanished in between the shops, the kids trailing after her. Erica was so focused on Ivy's reaction to hearing the name of the pub that she didn't take in what Ivy had just said. She quickly opened her door and followed them to the entrance of a dank alley. She peered down, but it was too dark to make them out in the shadows.
"Ivy!" she shouted. "Ivy! What do you mean you don't ever go in there? Why don't you?"
Erica started down the alley, the streetlights quickly fading.
She felt something soft and squelchy under her feet. "Ivy, I can give you more money. You just have to tell me what you know." She pulled out her phone and flicked on the light. The alley was filled with empty needles, condoms and discarded packaging and price tags.
"I'm investigating a murder," she continued. "The glue pot was the last place this girl was seen."
Her voice echoed. There was no response. She reached a 10-foot-high chain-link fence with metal spikes on top. Beyond, she could just make out a scrubby yard with some discarded gas canisters. She looked around. "Where the hell did they go?" she said under her breath. She doubled back down the alleyway, but she could see no way out, just the high brick walls of the building either side. When Erica came back to the car, her door was still open, the warning alarm gently chiming. She looked around and got back in. Had she imagined them? She spent a few seconds worrying that she had hallucinated the whole episode. Ivy, the kids. And then she felt a throb of pain in the back of her hand and saw the square sticking plaster. She quickly activated the central locking, then pulled away with a squeal of tires. Fresh adrenaline surged through her body. Something wasn't right about Ivy's reaction to the glue pot. She had been terrified. Why? Erica didn't care how late it was, or how deprived she was of sleep. She was going to check out that pub. Chapter 11. Erica drove back over to Forest Hill and parked a couple of roads back from the high street in a quiet residential area. The pub was halfway up the high street, a two-story brick building with a wine-coloured frontage. The glue pot was written in white, the tea trailing away to a cartoon of a paintbrush hovering above a pot of white glue. It was an irritating sign, both naff and clueless. There were four windows, two on each story with thick stone sills. The windows on the first floor were dark. Of the two below, one was boarded up, leaving the other to glow murkily behind a net curtain. Despite the cold, the outer door was wedged open. A sign promised that if you bought two glasses of house wine, you could get the rest of the bottle free. Erica went inside and found the bar was accessed via an inner door with badly cracked safety glass. The bar was almost empty, with just two young men sitting smoking at one of the many formica tables. They glanced up at her as she passed, taking in her long legs, and then returned to their beer. A small dance floor to one side was filled with old stacking chairs, and a Magic FM jingle played over the sound system, introducing the opening bars of Careless Whisper. Erica went to a long, low bar at the back that was framed by hanging glasses. A dumpy young girl was sitting watching Celebrity Big Brother on a tiny portable television. "Double vodka with tonic, please," Erica said. The girl heaved herself up, reached for a wine glass, then pushed it against an optic, keeping her eye on the screen. She was wearing a faded Kylie Showgirl Tour T-shirt, stretched to capacity over her large bosom and dumpy frame. She adjusted the back of the T-shirt, pulling it down over her large backside.
"You're looking for an au pair, childcare?"
the girl asked, presumably having picked up on Erica's slight accent. Erica detected the hint of an accent in the girl too. Polish, Russian, she couldn't place it. The girl pushed the glass against the optic again. "Yes," said Erica, deciding to play along. The girl pulled out a plastic bottle of tonic water and filled the wine glass up to the brim. She placed the drink down on the bar, then slid across a square of card and a biro.
"You can put the card on the board for £20. New cards go up every Tuesday. £23.50 for that and a drink," she said.
Erica paid and sat down, taking a gulp of the drink. It was warm and flat.
"Why didn't you send your husband?" asked the girl,
watching to see what Erica wrote on the card. "Like I need my husband to drink more." The girl nodded with familiarity. Erica moved over to the small corkboard the girl had indicated, which was on the wall beside the bar. It was plastered with hundreds of cards, one over the other, handwritten in Slovak, Polish, Russian, Romanian, all advertising construction jobs, childcare, or au pair positions. "Is it always this quiet?" asked Erica, looking around at the empty bar.
"It's January,"
shrugged the woman, wiping ashtrays with an old cloth. And no football.
My friend got her old pair from an advert here, said Erica, coming back to her bar stool.
She get many women in here, young girls looking to be au pairs, sometimes.
My friend said there was a girl looking for work, that I might meet her here.
The girl stopped wiping an ashtray and regarded her with a cold eye.
Erica took another sip of her drink, then pulled out her phone. She scrolled through to the picture of Andrea and turned it round.
This is her.
Never seen her, said the girl a bit too quickly.
Really? My friend did say she was in here just a few days ago.
I didn't see her.
The girl lifted up a wire tray half filled with empty glasses and went to leave.
I'm not done yet, said Erica, placing her police ID on the bar.
The girl hesitated and put the wire tray back.
When she turned, she saw the ID and looked panicked.
No, it's okay. I just need you to answer my questions. What's your name?
Christina.
Christina?
Just Christina,
she insisted. Okay, just Christina, I'll ask you again. Have you seen this girl in here? The girl looked down at the picture of Andrea on the phone and shook her head so furiously that her cheeks wobbled.
Were you working here the night of the 8th? It was a Thursday, just over a week ago.
The girl thought about it and shook her head again.
Are you sure? She was found dead earlier today.
The girl chewed her lip. Are you the landlady?
No.
You just work here?
Yes.
Who's the landlady or landlord?
Christina shrugged.
Come on, Christina, I can find out this information easily with the brewery. And those men were smoking in here despite the smoking ban. Do you know how much that would cost in fines? Thousands of pounds. And then there's the illegal employment agency. You just charged me £20 to advertise. I could make a call and have a team of officers here in 5 minutes, and you'd be responsible.
Christina started to cry. Her huge chest heaved. Her face went red and she scrubbed at her beady little eyes with a corner of a tea towel.
If you can just answer a couple of questions, said Erica, I can make sure that you are seen as an innocent employee.
Christina stopped crying and caught her breath.
Okay, it's okay, Christina. Nothing bad is going to happen. Now, please, look at this photo again. Did you see this girl here on the night of the 8th? That was last Thursday. She was abducted and murdered. If you can tell me anything, you might help me find whoever did this.
The girl looked down through swollen eyes at the picture of Andrea.
She sat there in the corner,
she said, finally. Erica turned and saw the small table by the dance floor. She also noticed that the two men drinking had gone, leaving half-full pints.
You sure it was this girl?
Said Erica, holding up the picture on the phone again.
Yeah, I remember how beautiful she was.
Was she alone? Did she meet anyone?
Christina nodded.
There was a young woman with her, short blonde hair.
As short as mine?
Asked Erica.
The girl nodded. Anything else?
They had a drink or two, I don't know. It was a really busy night and...
Erica could see she was becoming more worked up and scared.
Go on, Christina, it's okay, I promise.
Then I don't know where she went, her friend, but when I looked again there was a man sitting with her.
What did he look like?
The woman shrugged. Tall, dark, they argued.
What do you mean, tall and dark? Can you be a bit more detailed?
Said Erica, trying to hide her frustration. This was a real breakthrough, but Christina was being too vague. She made a decision and pulled out her phone.
Christina, I want you to come with me to the station and do what we call a photo fit of the woman and man you saw Andrea sitting with.
No, 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 no.
Christina started, backing away.
Erica dialed the number for the duty desk at Lewisham Row. It started to ring. Your information could lead us to finding out who killed this woman, Andrea.
But I'm at work and...
I can get the officers to come here. We can do this now. The duty officer picked up the phone.
It's DCI Erica Foster. I need uniform and a squad car to the Glue Pop Hub in London Road in Forest Hill. And who do you have on duty who can do a photo fit?
There was a movement, and Erica realised Christina had darted through a door at the back of the bar.
Shit. Hang on, I'll call you back.
Erica swung herself over the bar and through the doorway to a filthy little back kitchen. A door stood open. Erica stepped into the alleyway. It stretched away long and empty in both directions. A light dusting of snow began to fall. It was eerily silent.
Erica walked the length of the alley in both directions. The houses backing onto it were dark, and the roads at either end were empty. The snow started to fall more heavily, and the wind whistled through the buildings. Erica pulled her coat around her against the freezing cold. She couldn't shake off the feeling she was being watched. Chapter 12. Two uniformed police officers were called to the glue pot, but an extensive search came up with nothing. Christina had vanished. The flat above the pub was unoccupied, filled with a mess of junk and old broken furniture. It was gone midnight by the time that the officers told Erica to knock off and get some sleep. They would remain stationed at the pub, and at first light they would track down the landlord. If Christina came back, they would bring her in. Erica still felt spooked when she returned to her car, parked a few streets away. The streets were silent, and every noise seemed amplified, the wind keening as it blew around the buildings, a wind chime on the porch of a house. She could almost feel the gaze from the black windows of the houses all around. From the corner of her eye, she saw a shadow move in one window. She turned, but there was nothing. Just a dark bay window. Was someone watching her from the shadows? She realized she was in desperate need of rest. She would find the first hotel and book in. She unlocked her car and climbed in, activating the central locking. She sank into the comfort of the seat, leaned back her head, and closed her eyes. It's a baking hot day on a run-down street in Rochdale, and Erica's protective police gear sticks to her skin. She shifts uncomfortably, crouched against the low wall of a terraced house, looming tall in the heat. Two officers are beside her, mirrored by three officers on the other side of the front gate. Mark is with them, second along. From weeks of surveillance, the terraced house is burned into her brain, bare concrete out front, overflowing wheelie bins, a gas and electric meter on the wall with its cover ripped off. Through the front door up the stairs, a door to the left of the landing leads through to the back bedroom. That's where they cook the meth. A woman has been seen going in with a little kid. It's a risk, but they are prepared. Erica has drilled the routine over and over to her team of eight officers. Only now they are stationed outside. It is real. Fear threatens to roll over Erica, but she pulls back from it. She gives the nod, and her black-clad team moves stealthily, surging down the path to the front door. The sun glints off the disc in the meter as it spins. Once, twice, almost matching the thunk of the battering ram, on the third attempt, the wood splinters and the front door bursts inwards with a clatter. Then all hell breaks loose. Shots are fired. The window above the electricity meter explodes inwards. Shots are coming from the house behind them. Erica's head spins round. The nice house across the street. Sash windows. Brass numbers on the door. Farrow and ball paint on the walls inside. The couple had been so welcoming, so unassuming when the police had carried out their surveillance. It falls into place as Erica's eyes are drawn to their upstairs window. She sees a dark shadow. Then pain explodes in her neck and she tastes blood. Mark is suddenly beside her, crouching down to help. She tries to speak, to tell him, "It's behind you." But blood fills her throat. In the hysteria, it's almost funny. Then there is a cracking sound, and the side of Mark's head is blown open. Erica woke with a gasp, trying to catch her breath. She was surrounded by an eerie brightness pressing down. She exhaled and her breath came out in a long stream. It was only when she saw the steering wheel in front of her that she got her bearings. She was back in the present, sitting in the car. A fresh layer of snow had fallen, completely covering the windows. It was a familiar dream. She always woke up at the same point. Sometimes the dream was in black and white, and Mark's blood looked like melted chocolate. She breathed in and out, her heart rate slowing, The reality sinking in. She heard muffled voices and footsteps, people walking past the car. The voices grew louder and receded. She looked at the digital clock on the dashboard.